I'm Peter Elkin. I'm a professor of medicine, and I have a bunch of titles. I just moved from the Mayo Clinic, although I'm keeping an appointment there, to Mount Sinai in New York. And I'm actually going to have a wonderful job where I get to work on the academic side as center director for informatics, but also get to work as the vice chair of the Department of Medicine, giving me the academic credentials to move things into practice, and vice president of the hospital, so giving me the direct line IT control to actually get comparable data on the throughout the health system. So I'm very excited about the opportunity and look forward to what we can do there. We have wonderful co-authors, including Dave Froling, Dietlin Rodler, Brett Trusco, Gail Welsh, Hobo Ma, Armin Astrayan, and Jerry Tokers, Trent Rosenblum, and Steve Brown, who worked on this project with us. We had a meeting of our group, and actually, this is just a portion of the group. One of our members, Jan Tallman, who you may know because he's the editor-in-chief of the International Journal, did a mind map for us of all the expertise in the group, found out we had some smart people we were working with, and I was definitely not the smartest one in our group. This was really fun. So we've gotten a lot of press lately. We've been working in electronic quality monitoring, looking at these kinds of rules that I'm going to show you today and how we do our reasoning on the kinds of constructions that we produce through natural language processing. And actually, Government Health ITs wants to do another article on us. And then we published this paper that's over on the left, which was Steve Brown was the first author, which we believe still to be the first article ever on fully automated electronic quality monitoring in the literature. And unless someone can teach us differently, we think we coined the field equality, you know, like e-prescribing, equality. But it's a great double entendre because it equalizes the quality of care, and it's this electronic quality. You know, you get it? You guys get it. Okay, I'm going. All right. So let me start out with a case because I like to bring this home to patients because we're here about patients, okay? So this is Bill Kinney. Do we have any clinicians in the audience? Okay, one. Okay, we're going to keep this non-technical, okay, from a clinical perspective. So Bill Knievel's 49-year-old guy. He's on vacation with his family in Florida. His driving conditions are wet and slippery, and after being cut off, his car impacts an embankment. Unconscious, he's taken to Florida General Hospital's emergency department. He routinely gets his care at St. Elsewhere in Boston. Records are requested from Florida General Hospital, and text records are sent, which show Mr. Knievel to have a past medical history of hypertension, type 2 diabetes. He's currently on lisinopril, hydrochlorothiazide, metformin, and aspirin. So in the emergency department, he's found to have a heart attack. He had a troponin T, which is a biochemical test that can show myocardial damage of 0.42, and in fact, that's elevated. His complete blood count was normal. He had a creatinine of 2.7, which is elevated. Normal electrolytes and a glucose of 187, which is elevated. Remember, he's a diabetic, but his beta-hydroxybutyrate was not elevated. That means he wasn't in ketoacidosis, and his bicarb was normal. He did have ketones in his urine, which some lesser docs think is ketoacidosis, but isn't. So what happens today? Today what happens is he's continued on his present medicines, a beta blocker started. However, 2 days later, his potassium 7.2, his bicarb is 14, which is very low, meaning he's acidotic. Mr. Knievel's rhythm degenerates into ventricular tachycardia, followed by a cardiac arrest, and in spite of an aggressive resuscitation attempt, he passes away. So what do we envision? We envision that data from St. Elsewhere will be transmitted to Florida General Hospital in a standards-based, codified, interoperable format. Dr. Overwork, the admitting physician, uses an order entry system that provides decision support and incorporates into its logic the data transferred from St. Elsewhere. The system alerts the admitting physician that with a creatinine of 2.7 or greater than 2, the metformin should be discontinued due to the serious risk of metabolic acidosis. Dr. Overwork DCs the metformin, orders sliding scale insulin. 2 days later, Mr. Knievel's potassium is normal, his bicarb's normal, his creatinine, which is a measure of his renal function, is trending toward normal. On the fourth day, he's discharged in good condition. His family decides to take a repeat trip to Disney World next year when Dad feels a little better. For Mr. Knievel and informatics standards in Florida General Hospital's clinical decision support system made an immeasurable difference for him and his family. And these are the kinds of people who put their trust in us. So for those of you who are a little more modern, this is a little more modern example, Mr. Knievel's son, Michael, he's inconsolable. You know, this is a tough situation, going to, you know, having a car accident on their way to Disney World. So his pediatric records from St. Elsewhere shows that he's considered healthy, but due to his behavior and separation from his parents, he's visited by a child psychiatrist. It's determined that Michael is suffering from an acute stress reaction. They wish to prescribe a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, namely escitalopram or Lexapro is the brand name. However, Michael's St. Elsewhere records show this DNA sequence to have a polymorphism associated with a non-functioning CYP3A4 enzyme. This enzyme is one that actually metabolizes that drug, okay? Okay, so indicating that he'd be a poor metabolizer of escitalopram. So instead of that, he's placed on Zoloft or sertraline, which is metabolized by the P450 CYP2D6, CYP2C19 pathways, where he's known to have a STAR1, which is a normal phenotype. And this medication decision avoids subjecting Michael to potentially serious medication side effects from being overdosed on the escitalopram. So what are we doing here? We're taking data. We're taking that data, we're analyzing it, and we're getting information, taking that information, applying it to patients or to a public health situation, and we're getting knowledge. Then we take two pieces of knowledge, we put them together to learn something we could not have known from either piece of knowledge separately. And what does that produce but intelligence? And that intelligence, I believe, will allow us to do better public health response. So the idea is comparable data, so however we get it. So let's say we have outbreak one, outbreak two, and they're all defined by the same ontologies. Now we can start making commonalities because we have common meaning across these, and we can start to build them up till we have multi-center data sharing and interchange. So this requires an infrastructure, and I'll just go quickly through ours and then show you a little bit about the results of this study so that you understand how we got to where we are. So this is data, patient data, that is organized by ontologies. And there are only three kinds of knowledge in the world. There's ontologic knowledge, which is definitional. There's assertional knowledge, which are facts about medicine, like if your creatinine is greater than 2.0, you shouldn't be on metformin, okay? Right? Or it's actually 1.5, some people would say. But anyway, those are facts about medicine that are assertional knowledge. And then there's instance data about patients. So this particular patient has, like Peter Elkin, if I had pneumonia, Peter Elkin's pneumonia would be an instance of pneumonia. So what we take is all that instance data and we organize it by the ontologies. So the ontologies are the organization of knowledge that we know about medicine. And then we have a generic rules engine that we built on top of it you can start to ask queries against. And then we created a set of mathematics. Looks better on my monitor. I should turn my... See, looks better on my monitor. Okay, so I like this because it got picked up as a work of art, too, by the American College of Physicians. But basically, this is a set of mathematics we came up with we call conceptual relativity that tells the formal distance between any two concepts in health. It's a compositional function, so you can ask the question, okay, show me all the cases within some fixed distance of this case definition, then you can vary the distance, get an ROC curve, that kind of thing. So yeah, we think it's neat. It's the first example of real phenotypic clustering that I'm aware of. And then from there, you actually can get, so what are you doing? You're building up these little semantic networks inside of bigger semantic networks, inside of bigger semantic networks, inside of very, very big semantic networks. And then what you can do is you know, you've got all these relationships that you had never really understood were there before. So you can write these intelligent agents, which are these supposedly depicted by these two-headed guys, that run through this and find associations that nobody's ever thought to think about before. So this has to do with ontologies. This happens to be the HL7 reference information model. It's a level one ontology because it's domain independent. It's true, things that are true about the whole world. You can fly to the moon with this as well as write a prescription. And this is a level two ontology. It's just one we developed for an EHR. And it does some things I like. It's completely secure. It has the ASTM security and ISO security models underneath it. It's got one single point of audit at the episode of care. Everything goes through a privileged clinician and their encounter, non-encounter events. But it talks about stuff we like to talk about in medicine. Medications, adverse events, diagnoses, symptoms, procedures, results, orders, that sort of thing. And that's a level two ontology because it's not specific, but it's domain specific. And a level three ontology is the fully encoded health record, the details of the clinical encounter. And this is consistent with the level one and level two ontologies, and that we think this should be done in the usual process of care. So the way our systems work is we take unstructured text, just ASCII, and we put it into a common XML structure. We have several of them. One's a CDA structure, another's a Mayo particular format, and we have one that's simply the CMS format. The CMS has its own format for reporting, and so we have that too. And then we take that and encode it completely, and then we have audit tools that look at the encodings. And so that's basically the workflow. So if you look at this is that same record. This is all the things that are in color are codified. So the blue things are positive assertions, the red things are negative assertions, and the green things are uncertain assertions. And you can see that although we don't get everything in the chart, we get the lion's share of the information out of the clinical work. And we'll talk about this a little bit more as we go forward. So clinicians and researchers, we believe, need a comparable mechanism to assess medical record data. And we want to put that stake in the ground in the 21st century. And this is a concept by Don Berwick of the Institute of Healthcare Improvement. So here's our architecture for those of you who are a lot of technical people. I skip this one, but it looks like a lot of technical people in the audience. So basically, we have the dual path. It's a J2EE architecture. Basically, it's a four-tier architecture. We have whatever the input is. Databases could be a web screen, whatever. Goes to a typical web server middleware tier, then which is a web services tier. Then it goes to an RMI server. We use that instead of document-based models of web services because it's faster. And we have a high-performance computing application. We need to get every bit of juice out of that thing we can. And then it goes to the databases on the back end. And then there's a separate set of SAN servers that you actually store the data that's indexed. So you have the terminology server, and then you have the data for storage at the bottom. So a little caricature of how that happens. Somebody transcribes a note. It goes in. It matches against the terminology server. What gets stored are just codes. And then when they never see the codes, the clinician never sees the codes, then someone asks a question. They ask it in English, and it translates it into code. But in the back end, where it matters, it's all code against code. There's no text against text when you do retrievals. So we use SNOMED CT for this process. SNOMED CT is a description logic-based terminology. It is a compositional system, and I'll go into what that is in a little more detail in a second. It has about 370,000 concepts out of the box and about 1 million terms. And we add about 790,000 terms to it to make it clinically friendly because pathologists don't speak like the rest of people in medicine all the time. Anyway, and then we add about 30 to 60 million, I think it's up to about 60 million indices now to make it run fast. When we started parsing records years ago, it took us 18 hours to parse a record. Now we're down to about 20 seconds. So a lot of engineering behind that. But anyway, we were proud of the accomplishment. So compositional systems are where you can put things together to have greater functionality than the sum of their parts. So like this Lego train, the things that you put together with compositional units with inside of a controlled health representation or a controlled health ontology can create knowledge that has more description and greater functionality than the sum of its individual components. So at Mayo, these are four unimpeachable guys, William Warhol Mayo, Will Charlie, and Henry Plummer, who was the first internist. And they might say the same thing, but say it somewhat differently. And what we do is we coordinate that, and the same representation comes out. So you've got unanimity of meaning, which is the goal. So anyway, there was a computer problem I heard on the flights here out of Atlanta. And all I could think of was this, and that maybe that. So this is a little point before I get to the data, because then you'll just focus on that we're sort of hoping that you'll all want to adopt. Can anybody tell me who this patient is? Can anybody tell me what's wrong with the patient? Even if you know SNOMED really well, you might. These are SNOMED codes, so you might pick out a code or two. But everything you ever want to know about that patient is there from a clinical perspective, from a public health perspective, but none of the details. So, it's a pseudo-anonymized way to transmit data from clinical records that has all the information we need for our processing, but none of the story. So when I say none of the story, it doesn't have that this is the mayor's wife or that this is the captain of the football team in town or any of these uniquely identifying pieces of text that we see with inside of clinical records that pose a threat to sharing information. We believe that just sharing the extracted codes from the records, which is all we really need for our work, it would be more acceptable to the general medical public. And hope you'll join on. So these are pseudo-anonymized records. Translation tables exist at the local healthcare organization. No text, not human readable. The data exists without the story. And we have lots of data. So it's patient documents, section, subsection, problem, sentence, compositional expression, concept level detail. Lots very specific. And for that, we know exactly what section of the record, each concept, we know whether it's a positive, negative, or uncertain assertion. We have any values associated with it. It's got a temporal model around it, all of that kind of thing. So you've got all the information you need to ask questions of it, but you don't have the story. So now getting to this particular specific project. So we worked through BioSense, and this is a national public health system that receives, analyzes, and visualizes health record data. And as of June of this year, they had 558 acute care hospitals, 826 of Veteran Affairs installations, and 354 Department of Defense facilities. Right now, they're sending chief complaints, some are sending diagnoses, and 42 locations are sending x-ray reports, both chest and skeletal radiographs. So we asked the question, can we actually do surveillance of radiograph textual reports for the purpose of identifying pneumonias? And so if you look at the importance of this, you know, a number of the category A bioterrorism agents manifest with pneumonia, including inhalational anthrax, tularemia, avian flu, plague, you know, and all of these. So there's a serious reason that we might be interested in this kind of surveillance. So the CDC had provided us with chest x-ray and chest CT reports that are, and these are frequently available, by the way, in a timely fashion. So people, you know, the residents usually read them right away, and that by the next day there's a final report. So you can get it pretty quickly. So in this particular study, we took 400 radiology reports were obtained. All the reports were reviewed by two independent board-certified internists. Where they disagreed with the judgment, a third one adjudicated, and we got a gold standard from it. SNOMED CT was used to parse the radiology reports. Then we created a set of SNOMED CT-based rules, and we're going to show you those in a minute, and the results of the NLP-based computational rule was compared with the gold standard. And we'll show you how well it did. So this is an example of a parsed record. This is an anonymized record, and it was a positive case that had pneumonia, where they had patchy pneumonia involving the medial aspect of the right lower lobe, and it was a pretty clear-cut case. There were some that were less clear-cut. This requires knowledge. In order to do the rules creation, it requires a lot of knowledge. To be a good rule creator, you have to actually train at this a bit. And we had, you know, a wonderful team of people who took a lot of time to understand SNOMED, understand logic, and then understand how to do the kind of constructions that are needed to create the logic that we needed. I'm going to go through the rule that was finally created. It was a lot bigger than we had expected when we first started. Here's the interface that we use. And it's basically you type in here anything in English. It automatically codes it. And then you combine things as Boolean logic with ands, ors, and nots until you create your rule. And then you can connect things with if-then-else statements. And then at the end, you have an action that happens based on it that you can specify. So, and you can say whether you want it to be a positive assertion, negative assertion, uncertain assertion that we search for, or a positive and uncertain, negative and uncertain are the categories. Whether you explode the concept, meaning you take all of its subconcepts or just the concept itself, and what sections of the record you want to look in when you write your rule. So where you should be looking. That's very important. And it turned out in this project it was extremely important to getting the right answer. So here's the rule we got. So what happens is when you type this in, of course, you get the SNOMED code just comes up for you. And then the rest of the things are, I could have translated them on here, but that's how it actually appears in the rule. And it says, you know, I want positive assertions of pneumonia that are coming from the impression section of the record. That's the first one. If you get that, you're done, you got it, you're good. Then if you have else, look for pneumonitis, because SNOMED had both pneumonia and pneumonitis, and we didn't think that one clinician might be more pathologically based and say pneumonitis, and another clinician might have said pneumonia. And so that gave you a positive assertion of pneumonia. And then if when we went back to the impression section of the record and we looked for an uncertain assertion of pneumonia and of both of these, and then we went on to there were three sections of the record that we saw before in that example record. There was the history, which was often the indication for the test. And often they would say rule out pneumonia in there or pneumonia, just pneumonia, and it wouldn't be pneumonia. You know, it would be CHF or something else. And then there was the findings, which were the graphic description of the densities that were found, and then there was an impression at the end in all these reports. This is the same as a VA and CDC format are the same anyway. So we looked first in the impression, then if we didn't find it, we looked in the findings, and we did not look in the history part. We thought the history part was just going to cause false positives. And when we looked at it, that was absolutely true. So then once you get down past the pneumonias, looking at the different sections of the record, we looked for infiltrates or consolidations, and the same thing in both in the number of places, both and these are codes for what happened at the end. And then if it didn't have that, we looked for other kinds of densities, opacities, pacification, densities, nodules, masses, granulomas, disease, that sort of thing, so that we could differentiate the other kinds of things that happen in the chest, which we thought was interesting. And if it got down to the end, it said there was no findings, whatever, it could have been a normal chest x-ray, right, that report. And often it did say normal chest. So when we looked at how the system performed, this was the most stringent criteria for its performance, where it had to get the uncertainty too. And we had 6 errors in terms of uncertainty, and all of those came because of a single problem, which we've been working on, which is that the clinicians felt that if you had a positive assertion, but it was in a list, that it was part of a differential diagnosis, and that made it uncertain. Whereas, you know, we didn't have that in our NLP rules when we did this project, and we're working on correcting that. Yet, we had 100% sensitivity, 90% specificity, and a positive predictive value of 70% in this particular, with uncertainty. And as far as we know, we're the only ones who are doing uncertainty. And then we did it considering uncertainty as a positive assertion because there were a bunch of other people in this study that, and because other people didn't like their results, I can't present their results. But anyway, we did it because other people couldn't do uncertainty, grouping uncertainty as a positive. And so we looked at how it did, and of course the performance when you group, you don't have those errors from that one type of uncertainty that we didn't get, the performance was very, very good, as you can see. So the point was, you know, there are lots of types of qualification for logic. And we did a study with a guy named Graham out of Princeton who looked at what kinds of iterator reliability could be found with different versions of uncertainty of in a multi-valued logic. So those of you who are logicians, I hope there's somebody in the audience who cares about this. But anyway, we found the following things to be reproducible between reporters. And that is, you see at the ends you have true, false, just as likely true as false, more likely true than false, more likely false than true, almost certainly true, almost certainly false. Those were the ones that could be actually reproducible. And the two false positives were both the errors in the negation grammar where there was sort of typos in the note, and we fixed that since, actually, because we found that. So, you know, we're trying to do this, of course, to find things more rapidly so we can respond to public health emergencies by identifying things for the CDC and for public health a little more quickly than we could previously. And so we created this thing, but we also wanted a way for subject matter experts to more quickly ask questions. So the more quickly you could ask a question, the less of a barrier there is to question asking. The more questions you will ask, the more you will learn, and the faster we'll move the science and our patient care and everything we're doing forward. So we call these like 5-minute studies, and I call the language that we write this in the health archetype language. And of course, if anybody's a science fiction fan, so HAL 42, I don't know if the authors are going to give me a hard time with this, but I just combined two of my favorite books. Never mind. Okay. You guys got to have a sense of humor, right? So, okay, so here's an example of a quick study, same line, data set. This is a clinical data set of 1,455 patients who had PCR-positive influenza. And then there was a match set of about 15,000 controls, of which we abstracted a match set of controls at the same number. And then we looked at this, and basically I asked the question, you know, we just said, well, we just came into office, so what question would you ask clinically? I said, well, you know, some people think that if you get the influenza vaccine and you still get the flu, that it'll be a milder flu, right? But, you know, and other people believe if you miss it, you missed it completely. So we didn't know the answer. So we did a study. We said, okay, well, one marker of that is the rate of complications. How quickly do you get pneumonia or strep pneumonia if you have influenza based on whether you were vaccinated or unvaccinated? And we did with or without people who had gotten the Pneumovax, right? So that we didn't confound it because the Pneumovax is clearly effective, right? So we ran this thing, and in 5 minutes, we got the results, and it showed basically no protection. The rate of pneumonia with the influenza vaccine, if you get influenza, exactly the same. exactly the same. So we're publishing this. This is good. Other one, not quite as public health relevant, but a guy came into my office, real smart guy, Kevin Fleming, and he said, you know, Peter, I've always seen in my practice that patients who have rosacea are much more likely to have obstructive sleep apnea. And he said, I went to sleep guys, they don't know anything about it. I went to the dermatologist, never heard of it. We ran it through the system, 4 times more likely, got the answer in 5 minutes, and we're gonna go and publish that. I mean, honestly, it's a great thing. So here's one that didn't work out, the same data set. We said, okay, well, let's see. Of our smokers, we wanna see how well we can get really qualitative information, stuff that you wouldn't think computers could do very well. So we looked at people who are counseled to quit smoking that are smokers. And at Mayo, only 2/3 were actually counseled to quit. Well, that's not what we want to do. We want to be well over 90%. We want to be telling people, you should always stop smoking if you smoke. You guys don't smoke, right? Quit smoking if you, because now I'm off the hook. I told everybody. All right. So some of the conclusions from this are that the technology and standards have progressed to the point where natural language processing is a viable solution. I'm sure we're going to hear that from the other presenters as well. That in our previous publications for clinical problems, we were able to show that our tooling had a sensitivity of 99.7%, precision of 99.8%, 5 errors per thousand, so you can do pretty well. It's reliable, you can use it. NLP can support biosurveillance, situational awareness, electronic quality monitoring, clinical decision support, information retrieval for research, and digital electronic educational libraries. So let's get back to our case. Remember Mr. Knievel at the beginning of this talk? Okay. What have we learned? Well, we've learned that our patients deserve from us, you know, the people we care for. And by the way, if you're in public health, you're caring for patients. Make no mistake about it, that we are here for one purpose and one purpose only, is to care for patients. I don't care if you write code or you are a person who helps with the booths or whatever you do, you are taking care of patients, okay? That's what you really do. And that's why we're here. And if you forget that, you've lost your way and you need to come back, because that's the real driver that makes this all work. And it makes you dedicated, and it makes you care about the outcomes. And there are real people. I take all of the people in my group, technical people, on rounds with me in the hospital, so they can see the patients and the families. They know why they're doing this. It's important. So, okay, so this requires utilization of all of the patient's relevant data, not just part of it. We have to utilize that data in the context of best practice. And of course, our hypothetical Mr. Knievel and his son Michael are just representative of the people who have put their trust in us to provide for them the very best care. This requires systems engineering that can help us to integrate and analyze patient data in order to provide clinicians with just-in-time, point-of-care, best practice advice in support of their medical practice. So in terms of BioSense and CT-based biosurveillance, we believe that intelligent electronic health records, that's what we are calling these fully encoded health records, can be helpful and facilitate the exchange of data. That radiologic reports are available in a timely fashion and are a rich substrate for information in support of biosurveillance and situational awareness. That pneumonia surveillance, in particular from radiologic studies, is feasible and with high quality results. And that an interface for subject matter experts to enter these, we call them quality rules, is necessary to facilitate rules construction. And so I believe that biomedical informatics as a field is moving toward, you know, intelligent records and fueling public health's need for effective electronic biosurveillance and situational awareness. So Machiavelli said in the 16th century that there's nothing more perilous to take in hand, more difficult to take in, more perilous to conduct, or more uncertain in its success than to take the lead in the introduction of a new order of things, because the innovator has for enemies all those who've done well under the old conditions and only lukewarm defenders in those who may do well under the new. This is just as true today, of course. You know, the other way to say that, you know, if you're 3 steps ahead of the crowd, you're a leader. If you're 10 steps ahead of the crowd, you're a target. So you have to really walk that carefully. The other quote I really like is by Peter Drucker of Harvard. He said, the best way to predict the future is to create it. I want us to go out there and do that. So in terms of this, we want more complete data, a fully automated approach, standards-based. Our particular view is you don't go looking for what you want. You parse once, and then you look for what you need in it. So parse once, use many. That's the mantra. And we believe that surveillance of radiologic reports can provide actionable data, and public health needs an accurate and fully automated mechanism for standards-based biosurveillance and situational awareness. And I thank you very much for your kind attention.